The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Friday, the end of our second week of this training period, this sesshin. The word sesshin means to unify or bring together the heart-mind. We step by step, breath by breath, go deeper. I think Rilke has some poem where he talks about a burrowing into the mountain. Tunneling into the great darkness of the mountain, deeper and deeper. We burrow into the heart of the world, the heart of the world right here, not some other place here in this Boundless Way temple. This temple here in Worcester, Massachusetts, the navel of the universe. We do talk about this stretch of Pleasant Street being the spiritual center of the universe, because in about a stretch of about a mile, there are probably five or six churches, synagogue, a friend's meeting house, Lutheran church, UCC, Catholic Church, our temple, so quite pleasant here on this street. And just up the road from us, another 20 miles, is the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, another internationally known retreat center, Theravadin Retreat Center, on Pleasant Street in Barry. And I guess sometimes pleasant, sometimes not so pleasant. I know that Thich Nhat Hanh used to talk about retreats, that it is a treat to be on retreat. And it's a very particular kind of treat, I guess. It's like that candy that doesn't really taste good, but you like it anyway. sometimes, of course, quite sweet, but maybe an acquired taste for some of us. But indeed, a treat, a deep treat. my grandfather used to say, after my grandmother had brought on the Thanksgiving meal, he would say, almost every year, he would say, "Well, this is a treat and not a treatment." So, but maybe this is both a treat and a treatment here. We're taking our medicine, the medicine of the Dharma, the medicine of our life, that this world teaches us. We take refuge in the Dharma. We say the Dharma take refuge in these teachings. But the Dharma is also means the things of this world. The Dharma is our life. And there is no other place to take refuge. There is no other place to stand other than here. So we take refuge in this moment. And as Melissa said so beautifully the other day, the Bodhisattvas appear out of the cracks in the sidewalk. But if you go looking for them, you will have a hard time finding them, because they might not be appearing in the shape you think they should. Most of us have such a strong preference for how the Bodhisattva of compassion should appear, and we think we know. And when she does not appear in that form, we say, why has she abandoned me? Clearly, she is not here. But the teaching is that the moment we call out the universe responds. That as Michael said so beautifully yesterday, this our life is nothing but a call and response. Each breath calling out. Each time we sit, we are calling out, we are heading into the center, into the heartland. The universe responds. But we need to be open. And part of this work is wearing ourselves down, cutting through, sanding away, grinding up the armor that we have so carefully constructed. The armor that at one point we learned we had to have to survive. And in fact, actually, of course, we should be happy for the armor that we have, because it has enabled us to be here, got you here. But we are seeking, we are practicing a transformation, or the possibility of transformation, the possibility that we might shift the focus of our life from protection to engagement, from protection to intimacy. The wonderful thing is that at every moment there is the opportunity to do this. This is, we might say, practicing compassion. If you want to grow in compassion, if you want to cultivate compassion, the time to do that is right at this moment, with whatever is arising for you. Even if what is arising is a cold and stony heart, or fearfulness, or confusion, even if what is arising is judgment and blame, you can practice compassion right in this moment, in meeting what is here, not being taken over by it, these mind states, these feeling states, these heart states that arise are quite seductive and can engage the mind, and we're off to the races, reinforcing our story, reinforcing the self. Whatever we encounter also is a moment of real life. This is real life. This is the only life, your only life. It will not start some other time. It will not be different. But right here, Dharma gates are countless. I vow to enter them. One student once told me she was quite discouraged by this. If the Dharma gates are countless, how will I enter them all? I myself tend to see that more encouragingly, so no need to worry about missing one. Just one after the other. No such thing as a window of opportunity. There is only this window. This window of opportunity. Life is, we might say, all windows. And I want to talk today, continuing with point six, the discipline of relationship, with points 25 and 26. 25, don't talk about faults. And 26, don't figure others out. So don't talk about faults and don't figure others out. These points in this section are about how to bring this practice of compassion, this practice of open-heartedness into action, And we've talked about this, the absolute bodhicitta, this quality of oneness and compassion, that the teaching is this is the ground of the universe. Again, I think we can't say it enough, this is a teaching not to try to believe, but a teaching to consider, to check against your own experience. Zen encourages us to be skeptical and to check with our own experience. And when you enter into this moment, then what do you find? And another entry point might be, what if the nature of the universe is compassion? What if I survive not by my wiles and skills, but what if I survive because of some life force that has been given to me, or some life force actually that I am? Have not been given something. It does not belong to you. It is who you are. As Melissa and I have walked with our daughter and son-in-law through their pregnancy, she has this wonderful app on her phone that every week in the pregnancy, it gives you the size of the fetus, and oftentimes in the form of a vegetable. Or a nut, you know, so now he's the size of a walnut, and has, you know, looks like a seahorse, or, it's just extraordinary how this being, has emerged. And I'm quite proud of my daughter and her brilliance for being able to construct a human being in her belly. But she claims not to know how, it is actually happening. And I'm sure my little grandson does not know anything other than exactly how to be human. All of the ultrasound pictures now, 10 fingers, 10 toes, tongue, ears, earlobes. How do we do this? How do you live? How do you breathe? How do you circulate your blood? How do you operate your kidney and your liver? We don't know. We indeed are a walking mystery. But indeed we do walk and breathe and sit and lie down. So this is the absolute bodhicitta that nourishes us, that is what we are. We are each one an expression of absolute love, we might say. We are the universe universing in the particularness of us, not in some vague general philosophical way, but in the particularities of your life, each thing. And it is in these particularities that we get to do our work. We get to practice. This, the work of relationship, the discipline of relationship, it's quite easy to, when I'm just with myself and my mind, I have all of these fantasies about who I am. Quite in, and in my mind, I'm quite flexible and open, and I don't like the snickering I'm hearing now. quite willing to go with what's going on. But in practice, I find sometimes I have quite strong opinions, and in the moment of the opinion, I feel quite righteous and sure of the opinion, and then. Sometimes later, quite embarrassed. What seems so important when I step back, maybe not so important, but this is how it is, and then we get to see ourself. I think for most of us, being in relationship is quite embarrassing. It is for me. When I see my pettiness and my clinging, when I see how self-righteous I can be, and when I see how much, how partial I see the world. We construct the world to fit our story. And the wonderful thing about being in relationship with a partner, with a friend, with yourself, is that we can begin to see where we are lost, begin to see the great embarrassment of being human, the great embarrassment of this mind that is so certain it is right. We humans will kill each other thinking that this is justified. Clearly I am right and you are wrong. But just step back a little bit and we see all of these currents rising and passing away. And this don't talk about the faults of others, and don't talk about faults is the first one. So easy to talk about faults. Faults are so interesting, right? Especially other people's, right? I'm very interested in what other people are doing wrong because it seems so clear, and I wonder how other people, why they can't just be as nice and as smart and as good as I am. And this perception of other people, and somehow imagining that other people are just some kind of inferior version of ourselves is quite a trap. And so we humans are endlessly talking, why did he do that? I thought he was this and she, and we really want to know. The other day, one of you was talking in a meeting about a book that happens to be one of my favorite books of all time, and written by an organizational consultant. And the title of the book is "The Answer to How is Yes." The answer to how is yes, and he says that to have a good and vital organization, and I would say to have a good and vital life, you need to clarify what is most important. What is it you really want? And that if you ask the question of how you're going to get there, that rarely is that helpful. Oftentimes we go there so soon, well, I don't know how, so we can't do this, so I can't do this, and I can't do that. But to really turn inward, what is our purpose? And he has this wonderful passage where he's talking about how we look around, and oftentimes we see the problem of our organization or the problem of our life is other people. And we see that what is blocking us is other people. And so he says, the behavior we describe in others may be an accurate description, but that is not the point. The point is, our focus on, quote, those people, unquote, is a defense against our own responsibility. The point is, our focus on those people is a defense against our own responsibility. The question, how do you get those people to change, distracts us from choosing who we want to become and exercising accountability for creating our environment. We cannot change others. We can just learn about ourselves. How wonderful. I went to several workshops with this guy, Peter Block is his name. Certainly he has had some of these same insights that arise in sitting He claimed to have no Buddhist affiliation, but I knew he was not telling the truth. But the question, how do you get those people to change? That is trying to figure others out, right? It's something when we begin to see how much time we spend trying to get other people to change. Now, of course, sometimes we need to and can give information and set limits and things, but his point here is that the real place we need to work, and I think this is the point of both this discussion of faults and don't figure others out, is to stay with ourself. He said, our focus on those people is a defense against our responsibility. The question, how do you get those people to change, distracts us from choosing who we want to become and exercising accountability for creating our environment. So this question, who do you want to become? This responsibility, which is not responsibility for other people, much as we would like to have control over other people, we would like to be able to make other people behave differently. Probably, fortunately, that is not given to any of us. The spiritual teacher Byron Katie talks about three kinds of three positions, three kinds of business. She says there's my business, your business, and God's business. So my business is everything about me, my thoughts, my feelings, my actions. Your business is your thoughts, your feelings, your actions, and everything else is God's business. She says when you spend time in other people's business and in God's business, you get lonely because you have abandoned yourself. Quite a lovely image, and certainly this is our practice, to turn our attention inward. We turn the beam of attention away from those things, figuring that out, to really see what is arising here. And then, of course, the whole world is here with us. In the Grassroof Hermitage, one line is, in just this place, an old man illumines forms and their nature. So in just this place, on this cushion, we are looking into life itself, but looking into life itself from the inside, not from the outside, not trying to get other people to do something different. And these two slogans, to turn our attention from the discussion of faults. And I think we can get caught in talking about the faults of others. We can also spend hours delightfully and painfully talking about our own faults. The inner dialogue is quite a matinee movie. You know, we've seen it 10 times, but there's nothing else playing, so we buy our popcorn and go inside and sit in the darkened theater, and they haven't swept the theater, and it's the same thing, but, well, I guess there's nothing else to do. So we watch that, yeah, no, I'm not good enough, and I'm never going to be, and see this. You know, it's quite compelling. Just like the story of other people who indeed say things that can be quite mean and nasty, other people who can really do things that are very painful. We are have all kinds of emotions that arise. So many ways to look at this, but to see how easy it is to get stuck in the anger, the response, you know, she said that and I'm going to teach her, I'm going to say this. And of course, when we enter in, when we participate, well, if you're going to do that to me, then I'm going to do this to you. My brother and I, many stories, best friends, spend all our time together, but very competitive, as I mentioned, in the playing instruments. But we used to play catch, go out on the front lawn with our baseball gloves and throw the ball back and forth. But if somebody made a bad throw, and you weren't quite sure, and you had to go chase it then. You might make a throw that was not quite so good so that they would have to chase it. But that quickly, the catch broke down quite quickly. It's then the ball goes throwing in the street and all kinds of places. But, you know, if you're going to do that to me, if you're not going to make a good throw to me, I'm not going to make a good throw to you. Human beings. And so we get into it. And that our resistance then actually validates the exact thing that we would like to be different. And our resistance, instead of stopping the chain, actually adds more energy to the chain. And our lovely chant from the Dhammapada, the unending truth phenomena are preceded by the heart. Those who speak or act with a darkened heart, then suffering follows you. Hostilities aren't stilled through hostility, regardless. Hostilities are stilled through non-hostility. So this encouragement to notice when we are lost in faults. Going back to the very beginning, the preliminaries, the four preliminaries, number three is the awesome and indelible power of our actions. So we're reminded of the preciousness of life, the certainty of death, the awesome and indelible power of our actions, and the unavoidability of suffering. But this power of our actions is also the power of our thoughts and the power of our words. There are consequences to our thoughts. There are consequences to our words, consequences to our actions. And not that we can control the world, but we do co-create the world we move into. And where we put our attention makes a huge difference in the quality of our life. One teacher says, what we give energy to persists and grows, and what we take energy from withers and fades away. And this is why we're encouraged to come back to the bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind. What is it you really want to touch this and then in your actions to embody this so that we're not working against something. If you try to stop the thoughts you don't like, you will just give them more energy. So instead of trying to stop the thoughts, we just come back to the breath. Let the thoughts be. When someone insults you, you don't have to insult them back. Maybe that's actually not a good strategy. When someone makes a bad throw and you're playing catch, maybe you don't have to make a worse throw. Maybe you can throw it right back to them and go on playing catch. So this is, don't talk about others' faults and don't figure others out. Come home. Ollie, ollie, home, come free. Can be right here and to rest in the fullness of just this moment. Thank you. So, as you know, this talk is being recorded, and we're going to move into our Dharma dialogue. If you'd like to say something that you'd like to be turned off for, please let us know. We'd be happy to turn it off. But let's start with names. I'm David.
Melissa.
Bill.
Jenny.
Judith.
Susan.
Vincent. Harold.
Ray.
Henry.
Michael.
Carolyn.
Esther.
So, comments, questions, observations about this talk or these points or anything else about practice? Yeah.
A lot there. I guess I was thinking about sometimes when I'm around angry people, it seems like their anger is, you know, you can't swim right. You can't swim right, yelling at the raven, you know? And you can't fly right, yelling at the salmon. Yeah, I was thinking about that as you were talking, and then yeah. I was also thinking, don't figure others out and say, well, you're a salmon. I know you. Yeah. I'm going to put you in this swimming place.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that came up was it was in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, something like, it, I don't think it used the word control, but like if you want to control people, watch what they do. Like, to sit back and watch.
Yeah.
So, I'm thinking about all of those.
Yeah.
Talking.
Yeah. Well, I think that the way we get angry with people for being who they are, thinking that they should be different, and it the other Byron Katie thing that Melissa often quotes is, if you fight reality, reality always wins. And she says, you can try to teach a cat to bark as long as you want, and in the end, the cat will say, meow. So there is something, and also, this, we really don't know who other people are, right? And we think, oh yeah, I know what Mike should do. Yeah, it's very clear, he should. But you don't know. I mean, we, of course, we don't even know what we should do. But this this delusion of, I see you clearly, I know you should be swimming, Raven, right? And it's quite painful to live that way. Yeah? Thanks. Yeah, Ray.
This is what has been done to us since we were very young.
Yeah.
And so we have internalized these habits, and you know, often done without even aware of what we do. This is what we do. So I think, you know, that you will. It's a good slogan to have, because we will just mess it up over and over again. We will fail, if you will. But the practice of noticing what's going on, you know, what's the satisfaction that I'm experiencing, and rather than putting it out there, see what's going on with me, what's this dissatisfaction all about with the way things are, can be very useful to, at least for me, begin to, not change the other person, but be more aware of what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So the actual doing of the habit, if I bring awareness to it, it's a gate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and that's part of the gift of that. We are all enclosed in the bubble of our mind world, And it's quite difficult to actually get any new information because the mind perfectly makes everything fit. So these moments when irritation or anger or something arises are actually a moment of being able to get a little more free or a little more wiggle room in it. Yeah. Thanks.
Well, don't mean to be snide. The Peter Block book said, don't try to improve others in the work situation. Try, you know, work on yourself. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, even that, is that possible to improve yourself?
Oh, what a great point.
You can take, perhaps, behavior in work and do certain things, file your papers a little better, or try to be more polite to people at work. But really, in a truer sense, can you improve yourself?
I think you can become more clear about what's important for you and that you can act more in alignment with what is most deeply true. And I think you can't change who you are. But I think that to clarify that, to know that, and then act in alignment with that is in some ways what we're doing here.
I think this is very much in alignment with what Ray was just saying and David's response to Ray. You know, that this isn't, I think the mistake we make is thinking that thinking about improvement from a certain external sense.
Yes.
And really what we're doing is we're investigating the self, you know, like Dogen says, to study the way is to study the self, that we're looking inwards, and we're not improving ourselves, because obviously we can't do that. But we are getting to know the patterns of our own reactivity and responses better and better and better. And then when other people, I think this goes to also to what Ray was saying, act towards us in a way, actually what Jenny was saying too, in an angry way and putting us in categories, to be as interested in what's going on for them internally as we've trained ourselves to be interested in what's going on with us internally, rather than taking what they're saying at face value. I've learned that lesson the hard way, you know, believing when people are critical rather than being curious, like, where's this coming from? That would be a great first question. Marshall Rosenberg's work on what's it called?
Nonviolent
communication. It orients in that direction. You know, if you're having a dispute with somebody, you want to become very curious and not say, why are you saying this to me? What do you want from saying this? You know, what's your purpose? So kind of trying to understand from that level. So it's improvement is a very tricky word.
Is improvement going to be looked at as a side effect or a byproduct of this sort of internal workings of a coming sheen, working on these so-called problems we have? No.
I don't think so. I think it's a misunderstanding of what's going on in the path. I think we're not improving ourselves. We're going deeper and deeper into the essence nature of who we really are. So it's more of a shedding of things, and it's not a line to, now I'm a real sorry son of a bee, and then, you know, if I go to a lot of sashins, I'm going to be really awesome. I don't think it works that way. And, you know, there is a change, because as we got closer to being in resonance with our Buddha nature, with the Buddha nature, I should say, which is just compassion and wisdom and balance, it can look from the outside like so there's improvement happening.
Yes.
But it's more like I really think of it as a shedding of a protective barrier so we're more free to be bodhisattvas and Buddhas and to act in the world that way.
So the whole thing you're talking about sort of feeds into all the confusion that I'm struggling with that normally happens, that you speak right to me. So I've been thinking both here and in my life about noticing that I don't have very much control over my thoughts, and that when I get mad at myself for some thought that popped up, which I should know as a psychotherapist, I'm not entirely responsible for it. And then I'm becoming more aware that I'm not completely responsible for my actions, since at least the conscious me seems to be making the decision after the actions already happened. But now you're saying that we also are responsible for what's in our hearts, that that has such an effect on the universe. And I think, oh my God, how am I going to affect that if I can't affect the rest of it? And I guess the only thought that comes to me about what that really means, and I don't know if this is right, is that through awareness of, say, the anger that's in my heart, not trying to suppress it, not trying to deny or make nice when I'm feeling angry, but that being aware of it somehow conveys itself differently to other people? I don't know. Does it really?
Well, you know, that wonderful line from Joan Tollefson, awareness is its own action. I think what the awareness does, in keeping with what I was saying before, is it allows us to really see what's going on. And then it gives, we've been talking about, more space, you know, for things to unwind themselves. So hatred all by itself. The problem with an unending truth is that it's very dualistic. It comes from our Theravadan ancestors. Ostensibly the Buddha. But it can sound kind of like if you do this bad, if you do this other thing good. But really what we do in Zen is we talk about how you can't help feeling certain things, but what you do with those feelings is what's important. So you're onto something. Mm-hmm. So if we press, or if we try to talk ourselves out of it, or if we run away from it, and disguise it, and put up our barriers, then everything gets fixated. What we're talking about is allowing some freedom of movement. And in that sense, what you do with your hatred is going to have a profound impact on you and everyone around you.
And I think it's so important because all of us would like to have control of our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, right? I would. And the first, or one of the stages of practice is really getting to see it just fires and you say, my thoughts. But when you look closely, why does this one come now and that one come then? But that there is this possibility to be responsive, and that how we meet what arises determines the quality of our life. And so this, what we're cultivating, is not mind control or heart control, but the possibility of meeting with some softness and friendliness. And as Melissa said, Joan Tollefson, that when we meet it and do nothing, then the transformation, we don't even do the transformation. But we can see that what was arising was actually not what we thought it was. So this anger is arising. This is terrible. I'm a practitioner. Why am I angry at my daughter? Why should I? Yeah, I know I should not be angry. I'm just, but going to just that aliveness of arising, it's not what we think it is, and it is a kind of life, life in just the fiery that just comes up and goes down, and it is a treasure, sometimes a difficult treasure. But it is how we meet it. And that's why wherever you are, you can practice compassion. Even with the anger and the closed down that, deep resentment. I can't believe, my dog pooped on the rug again. So that comes up and you don't have to pretend, oh, nice, Fido, that's fine. You just want, you can really feel that anger and meet it with a kind of openness. Oh, this is how human beings feel sometimes. And then
he's going to sense that, isn't he? My dog.
That's right. That's right. And you may have to work with Fido in some new ways here, but you can work with what arises in new ways. And if Fido helps you work with yourself in new ways, then you better be grateful, to your Zen master Fido.
Well, and it's important to see that the space that we create around the thing itself actually provides us with new options for behavior. You know, our deeds are our closest companions. So it's not that Fido's just going to sense something. Obviously, you know, think of people who've been so angry with me that just because I'm working with receiving the anger in a spacious way, it's not going to stop them from, you know, writing emails.
It might.
Well, you never know. You never know. It's mysterious. But it's almost irrelevant because the spaciousness that I'm, so it's like a shift in view. And I always remember when I was, so I was new to Buddhism. I think I'd been practicing Buddhism for about 10 years when I started, doing, grief counseling as a profession. And those of you who are social workers and counselors and psychologists, may have heard of this technique. My mentor who was training me told me, when I was protesting, you know, these poor people, they're so lost. He said, oh, you should practice thought stopping with them. And I'm like, what is thought stopping? And he said, well, this is how you do it. You have them visualize the thought as if it was hanging on a wall. And then you have them imagine stepping away until it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's actually not thought stopping. It's a shift in view. And it's the same kind of thing, right? Suddenly there's other stuff. We've forgotten about it. I think Esther was talking about this the other day, about the illness. You know, look for a part of the body that isn't feeling sick. Because there's the world is vast and wide, and we tend to orient towards this tightness and forget about everything else. And I think that's part of what Zen... So I was able to agree with him. After I went, I was horrified and shocked, not stopping. I think I see
it's what you're saying. It's like your bigger pasture.
Exactly. It's what Shinryu Suzuki says about if you want to control your thoughts, you give them, you pretend that they're sheep and you give them a bigger pasture. You know, it's just so great, right? So it doesn't mean they go away. But and they will recur, of course, but they may not have the same sting.
So maybe one more, Esther.
Actually, it's a continuation of that, which is interesting. So, because one thing I experience or observe or notice is that when someone finds fault with me, my response could either be to sort of withdraw into the spaciousness and hold it, or fight. And go back and find fault. So as I've turned this into more and more of my practice, I notice there's such pain, say when a close relative, in this case my brother, continuously finds fault and really would like me to be different in so many ways. And so, and I would like him to be different too, but when you stay there, nothing really happens. So I feel that this practice of coming home to myself, say, like, he will text me in bullet points. Like, no hi or no goodbye, but just like, one, two, three. And so I turned it into a practice when you did that last time. I was like, wow, it really is his way of communicating. So how do I, you know, what works for me in this communication, instead of just rejecting it, can I interact with him in some way and even turn it into like a fun game? I know this sounds a little crazy, but it came up for me to do that instead of being all frustrated with the way he responds when I write, how are you, it's been so long, and he's just like, fine, or something. And then another thing was, you know, also in that there's something about the people that we really love, no matter how much they hurt us, to see if I can find a respect for his being and the way that he is in the world, that he needs to do something. You know, he needs to send me a Google invite where my name is on it to trust that I will pick up my nephew. And when I realized that that was what was going on, but instead of frustration, compassion arose. Maybe it's okay that he does send it to my email, but maybe I'll have to tell him it's fine that you put it in yours and your wife's. But trust me, I will pick him up on Thursday.
Yeah.
So I don't think you meant to point at us in this direction, but one thing I heard from what you said is we have to be also careful that we don't turn this practice into a technique for dealing with difficult people, right? Because that's the tendency. Human beings are really good at making strategies. So even the what I said earlier, and you picked up on it a little bit, but becoming more spacious. If we do that as a technique, it's just an escape, right? And so this meeting, the other thing that I heard you come up with is, so here's a human being with a set of ways of being in the world that's really different from mine, and could I join him? You know, it reminds me of the Laman Pong and his daughter's story about him falling in the mud and help, help, and the daughter throws herself in the mud next to him and says, "I'm helping you, father." Or when, you know, our daughter was a toddler and she was having a tantrum on the floor, you know, kicking and screaming on the floor, and I just didn't know what to do, and I just threw myself down and started kicking and screaming. What it did is it broke the tension. I didn't know to do it as a technique. I did it because I was so frustrated. And I thought, if you can have one, I'm going to have one. And she just looked at me like, what? Mommy? What? And then she went back to doing it, you know, because it didn't really work. But there is this, it broke later, you know, but there is this tendency that we all have. I want to make sure I say it out loud, that it goes all the way back to the beginning of the conversation. Right? This is not a strategy for being better people. This is not a self-improvement program. It is a seeing into the true nature of the self and being free in that. Very different kind of way of living.
Yeah. So let's practice that very different way of living right now.